It's the Burt Cohen Show. Makes the dream. We make the dream. We make America. Men and women, citizens, everybody gets to participate equally and fairly, right? Well, it's not always so clear about that. And you would think that by now we have made an awful lot of progress and really be nearing equality when it comes to women, work, and wages. 50 years ago, John Kennedy was still president, known for a lot of things. I doubt anyone has heard of his Equal Pay Act. Well, we haven't reached it there yet. On August 12th, our guest, organizer Judy Statman, led a public forum in Portsmouth on this subject, women, work, and wages in New Hampshire. Judy, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. What was that John Kennedy initiative, Equal Pay Act? What was it? And where did his impetus for that act come from?
Well, first of all, thanks a lot for having me on the show today. It's great to be here. So the 1963 Equal Pay Act was it was legislation that was brought to Congress at the urging of a group of professional women who were very sensitive to the fact that women were not being equally paid in the workplace. And it basically requires employers to pay men and women equally if they are doing the same jobs and have the same level of experience and competency. And, you know, that was 50 years ago. And frankly, women are still waiting for equal pay in America.
I find that amazing. You would think it's so obvious that, of course, you know, if people are doing equal work, they get paid the same amount, the same benefits, and, you know, just fairness. Why did it not, this 50 years ago, the Equal Pay Act, why did it not, did it pass? I believe it did pass. Did it not?
It did, and it was, you know, it was signed into law by President Kennedy, and then, again, there were even stronger provisions put in the Civil Rights Act, Title VII, which prohibits, you know, discrimination against women, really recognized women as a class of people who experience discrimination. And there have been other laws passed as well. In the 1970s, we saw laws passed that prohibited sexual harassment in the workplace. We saw a law passed in only in 1978, so not that long ago, that prohibited discrimination against pregnant workers. Progress has been very slow in coming, and it's, you know, you would think that, you know, in the 21st century and in the United States, that people who do the same jobs would get equal pay, but the General Accounting Office actually did a study back in it was back in 2003, but they looked at over 250 occupations, and they looked at male and female workers in those occupations at different levels of skill. So they had sort of entry level, medium, and high level, and there were only about five occupations where men and women made exactly the same. So we can ask questions when we ask, you know, why hasn't this changed? We can ask questions about, well, why are women dishwashers paid less than male dishwashers? Why do garage attendants who park your car earn substantially more than child care workers in America?
Amazing.
Who tend to be, you know, predominantly women? So I think there are a lot of factors that contribute to the continuation of the wage gap for women, but it's an issue that's becoming more urgent as more middle-class families are struggling to stay afloat in these hard economic times. And if women were making equal wages, it would be much easier on working families to sort of stay in the middle class and have retirement security. It would be, you know, a substantial increase in their family earnings.
I know that employers traditionally have felt like, well, you could pay a teenager less because he or she is not the main breadwinner for the family. And it certainly used to be the case, at least 50 years ago, probably longer ago than that, that employers could say, well, it's a second job for a woman. The man is the main breadwinner, so therefore they can pay less. I don't think they can even do that for teenagers, even though they know the teenager is not the main breadwinner.
Well, I mean, I do think that historically, you know, in America, for a long time, women were recognized as human, but not quite equally worthy as men in our society. That's kind of a nice way to put it. As Senator Martha Fuller Clark mentioned at the forum, you know, it wasn't all that long ago that women in New Hampshire were classified as their husband's chattel. So we've undergone profound both economic and cultural changes in the United States in the last half of the 20th century, and part of that was this idea that, you know, women are equal people and that they deserve equal treatment and that they deserve equal pay. You know, we're still working on all of these things, but I think with the question of equal pay, as I said, it's so economically important to American working families.
Yes. The middle class has been battered in the last 10 years or so. I mean, just decimated. If you look at, you know, graphs of the income distribution in the United States, say 20 years ago as compared to now, there was a large middle class. There was a genuine middle class. And now it's just decimated. It's amazing. I mean, if you haven't looked at one of these graphs, you really ought to, you owe it to yourself to check it out, because it's really astounding. You know, back, say, 60 years ago, it was possible for a family to be in the middle class with just a single income earner, which was most commonly the father in the family. How possible is that today?
Well, it's no longer possible today, and you're exactly right that, you know, when some of the really key New Deal labor regulations mm-hmm. were being drafted, the ideal then was to ensure a family wage, which meant that mm-hmm. you know, one person could earn, you know, enough money to support a family. And we certainly no longer have that in America, but you know, it is the case that for most working parents in New Hampshire and across America, both parents have to be in the workforce in order to pay the bills and right. put food on the table and all of the things that go into raising a family in our day and age. And in fact, one of the reasons that the wage gap has appeared to close a little bit is that since 1970, we've seen men's wages have simply stagnated, uh-huh. except for college-educated men with, advanced degrees. We've really seen men's wage just flat since 1970s. And one of the ways that families have dealt with this was to have another worker go into the workforce, have another adult go into the workforce. And that has, I think, is not something that's going to change. I think not mm-hmm. only do women have to work, many women really enjoy working. So mm-hmm. you know, it's something that we have not caught up with policy-wise in New Hampshire or the United States overall.
Well, I wonder, you know, if you look at this, I mean, it's so logical. It's been going on so long, and one has to ask, why isn't it happening? And we know there are people on the hard right, who apparently are the Republican Party these days, who have this mantra that they keep repeating about, you know, the family and family values. And I wonder if part of the roadblock to this is is that sensibility or way of describing things that, well, you can't have women working, that breaks up the family. Is that part of the roadblock here?
You know, that is a little bit of what's going on, I think, both in terms of getting policies in place that support maternal employment and the employment of people with family caregiving responsibilities, but also directly in the workplace. And I'm not sure that it's always so overt as, right. you know, mothers should be staying home and taking care of their kids. That's the only healthy way to raise a family. Mm-hmm. But there was the Pew Research Center did a public opinion survey in March of this year, I believe, or May, and they found that 50% of Americans, or slightly over 50% of Americans, said, you know, it's really okay if mothers work, but really families are better off if women stay at home when their children are young. And so there's still a very pervasive sense in our society that women belong at home when they have children in their household. And even though people realize that's no longer the norm in our society, it's still something that it's a preference. And I think that that has a very significant impact on how, you know, both women's wages but overwhelmingly on the policies that our Americans are willing to support that support working families.
And it's really fascinating what you're saying about men's income. It used to be, you know, in the 40s, 50s, and probably early 60s that men somehow could be a single breadwinner and that worked. And I remember, I've been in politics for a little while. It used to be that, there were buttons that said, I think 69 cents because women earned 69 cents to the dollar. And now it's women earn 77 cents as compared to what men earn. And it's interesting, as you started to talk about, what explains the narrowing of that gap? Is it that women's wages are up, or that men's wages are down, or is it some of both?
It's really some of both. I mean, it is the fact that overall men's wages have not grown at all for over 40 years, almost 45 years of stagnation. And employers are being more fair. There are more employers who are paying women what they deserve and are owed for equal work. But I think that we're really looking at a place where we are getting a little bit stuck. The Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C. has predicted that if it advances at the current rate, we won't have pay equity until 2057. And, I'm sorry, but that's a little long to wait for me. So I would like to see some action on this a little bit sooner. Families have waited a long time for this development. Women have waited a long time for it. And you mentioned the family wage a while ago, and we now have in America, because of the rise of divorced women, the rise of single mothers, and also because of the economic recession, men who are no longer working full time or men who are out of the workforce altogether, about 40% of working mothers in America are the primary breadwinner for their household. Mm. And that's an enormous change in our society.
It's huge.
It's huge. And for a large proportion of those women, all except for about 16% of those working moms, they're in the low income bracket. They're in low wage jobs. And particularly, we need to be concerned about, how are those families getting by? How are they getting what they need on these minimum wage, low wage jobs that are unfortunately female dominated in the U.S.?
If you just tuned in, our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is Judy Statman, organizer with the AFL-CIO, who led a public forum on August 12th about women, work, and wages in New Hampshire. And it's a fascinating subject. The percentage or number of women in the workforce back, say, in John Kennedy's time. I wonder if you know, Judy, what that might have been, what the percentage was then. You say it's about 40% now?
Well, actually, overall, women make up very close to half of the U.S. workforce. It's about 44% of the workforce. That's among full-time, year-round workers. In New Hampshire, tiny bit lower, not significantly. So we've got about... our full-time year-round workforce is about 42% female, and the balance is male workers. As far as working families, when you look back at, say, 1960, 1970, about 44% of married mothers were not in the paid workforce at that time. And that number really declined until about 1989, where it leveled off at about 25% of married mothers remaining out of the paid workforce. And it stayed there. That's where we are today, with about 25% of mothers not in the paid workforce and 75% working for pay. Now, not all work full time, particularly when their children are young. Many mothers say that they would prefer to work part time, but you know they're in the workforce.
So would fathers, I imagine, too. Quite frankly,
yes. Yeah, so would fathers, absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the problems that we have is, and really one of the reasons that I became very interested in labor issues and very interested in policy issues is, you know, when I started my own family and my oldest son just turned 20, I realized that we had absolutely none of the policies in place that support maternal employment that you find in every other wealthy nation and many other middle income and even low income nations on the planet Earth. You know,
really,
United States is just a complete outlier in its provision of policies and programs that support maternal employment. And we have one of the highest maternal employment rates in the world. So there's a real disconnect between what is happening in our society and how we provide these supports. And, you know, and I did a lot of going back and seeing, well, what were feminists saying about this in 1970? What were they saying about this in 1968?
Yeah.
And you can find, you know, book after book and essay after essay saying, you know, in 20 years, we will surely have, you know, paid parental leave. We will surely have paid sick days. We will surely have universal child care, because that's the direction that our country is going. And none of those things happened.
That's amazing, really. I mean, if you think about it, as you point out, so many other countries, the wealthy countries, the industrialized countries, but not just the wealthy and industrialized countries, recognize that it's good for society to have paid maternal or paternal leave so that parents can be there in their early years. And it's really odd that we say, you know, all for, you know, families, and but then we have policies that discourage it. And it's odd.
It's not only good for society, it's extremely good for women to remain attached to the workforce, you know, even in their active parenting years. The benefits to economic security are profound. And we're looking at a situation where, partly because sometimes women do choose more flexible work options, or they may take some time out from work if they can afford to do so when their children are extremely young. But, you know, we're looking at a lifetime earnings gap for college-educated women that's close to $2 million. So that's $2 million over a lifetime that, due to the wage gap, women are, you know, not having in retirement savings. They're not having, you know, to pay for the necessities of life as they go through and raise their families. $2 million is a whole lot of money to be missing out of your pocketbook just because you're a woman.
So this would be educated women as compared to educated men, a gap of $2 million lifetime earning?
That's right, yeah. Compared to a men, you know, with the same level of education,
right,
women are missing $2 million at the end of their earning career.
It's amazing, really. I mean, education is not always tied to increased earning, but oftentimes it is. And men and women do better with having a, you know, a college education at least, or a vocational training and things like that. But if there's an equal level of education, there's still about a $2 million lifetime.
Over a lifetime, you know, all of those 23 cents missing from every dollar that you earn for a woman who's in a higher earning career, it adds up to an estimated $2 million. For the lifetime earnings loss is somewhere between $434,000 and $2 million for women. And it really, I think it particularly affects retirement security. You have a lot of women hitting their late 60s, 70s saying, you know, I really can't afford to retire because if your earnings are lower, your Social Security benefits are also going to be lower.
There's an awful lot of men out there too who you see working
This is
well into their
70s. This is not exclusively a women's problem. I mean, it absolutely is something that is affecting all middle class workers now.
And I'm just curious. I don't know what the figure would be for how you would define middle class income nowadays. Here in New Hampshire, anyway.
I can tell you what the median income is, which is that means that 50% of people earn less and 50% of people earn more. For women in New Hampshire, it's for about $41,000. For men in New Hampshire, it's a little bit closer to 52-54, I believe, and I may be misremembering that. So my apologies to viewers if I got that, listeners if I got that wrong. But
it's significant.
There's a difference there, and it's partly because men and women in New Hampshire, and this is not at all unusual, are really concentrated in different types of occupations.
And that's one thing I wanted to follow up on. I mean, the nature of work in New Hampshire. New Hampshire used to be, you know, a big manufacturing state. You know, you look at Manchester and Rochester and places like that. There's a lot of shoe manufacturing, for example. You know, there used to be a lot of manufacturing across New Hampshire. In those old jobs, there were some women working in the shoe shops, places like that. Was there a different pay level for women back when we had a strong manufacturing base?
I would guess that if it was a non-union shop, there probably would be. Unionization makes a really big difference in pay equality for women. But I think it's exactly right. I mean, one of our problems in New Hampshire is that, you know, we've lost a lot of the good living wage jobs that our economy used to create, particularly in the manufacturing area. And those have been replaced with jobs in food service, jobs in retail, jobs that in general, you know, pay just a minimum wage or a little bit above it. And in New Hampshire, as in the country overall, the people who hold those jobs tend to be women. So, you know, women are concentrated in lower wage industries. But even when men and women are you know, working in the same industries, have the same educational attainment, have the same qualifications and experience, women are earning less. But also it is like the case that the jobs that women tend to be concentrated in, for example, 37% of women workers in New Hampshire work in either healthcare, education, or social assistance. And only 20% of men work in those industries, or I think it's actually closer to 10% perhaps. And the one industry where women and men make almost identical wages is construction, but only 1% of women in New Hampshire work in construction jobs. So men are much more likely to be self-employed in their own business. They are much more likely to be employed in technical fields and in building trades. And these are all higher paying industries than the industries that women tend to be clustered in. as far as the manufacturing, the manufacturing jobs in New Hampshire, men and women are pretty equally likely to be employed in manufacturing work. So that's may have been, you know, the case farther back, but today at least manufacturing jobs, men, you know, about the same number of the percentage of the working population of men and women are employed in manufacturing.
Now, here where this broadcast is coming from in Portsmouth, we have a very large employer, which is the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, which is largely unionized, I believe.
It is.
What's the experience of women there? I wonder what percentage it is, first of all, and then if there's rough equality there.
You know, I think that's a really good question, and I do not, off the top of my head, you know what percentage of Portsmouth Naval Shipyard workers in on the building side of the equation are women. Women are absolutely underrepresented in the building and technical trades.
Yeah.
And one of our panelists was Liz Skidmore, who's the business manager for Carpenters 118. In Manchester, and she right now is actively recruiting young women to go into the Carpenters Apprenticeship Program, which is a four-year program completely paid for, you know, by the carpenters and by the business owners, and you are paid to participate. You know, you get an hourly wage, which increases as you go through the program. It's a combination of classroom learning and on the job learning. And, you know, when you come out of that, a master carpenter earns effectively with benefits over $45 an hour. So, you know, you really are moving into a career path in the construction trades that is very, very much, you know, a solid middle class wage. But you know, on the other end, and you don't need a college education, you know, so it's there are opportunities for women, but there isn't a huge predominance of women in the building trades. I think in for the carpenters, they have around 16% or so.
So this new program sounds very attractive, I would think. Are enough women aware of it? Are they taking advantage of it?
I think that Liz is working really hard to get the word out about this program. I mean, she's very interested in hearing about young women who...
Who is this?
Her name is Liz Skidmore, and she is the business manager for the Carpenters Local 118, and is also been very involved in getting more women into the Carpenters Union in particular, but getting them into these good jobs in the building trades. So, and as she told us, you know, that you have to enjoy that type of work, but you don't have to be unusually big or strong to succeed at it. It's just if you enjoy that kind of working with your hands and that building things, you know, there is no reason a woman can't have an extremely successful career in the building trades.
And certainly I've had some great mechanics who happen to be of the female gender. You know, there's no reason why not.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that we hear a lot about women, get more women in STEM fields, in science, technology, engineering, and math, that stands for. Uh-huh. And, you know, there's a question of whether at this point those fields are so male-dominated that maybe young women are self-selecting out of them. We know that, you know, women are certainly going through college programs in engineering and math, and but it would be good to increase that number. But I think we also need to really look at living wage jobs for women who have less education, who have a high school education or maybe less, because they are definitely do not have the type of economic security that men with the same level of education are able to achieve. There's almost a $13,000 a year earning gap for men and women who have a high school education only or a little less than a high school education. And that's because women are pushed into, you know, very low wage jobs. And we need to have we need to have something for folks who are, it's still the case that, you know, 65 to 70% of women workers and also male workers in New Hampshire are not college educated. They do not have a college degree. I mean, I think we talk a lot about these higher, you know, higher end professional jobs as a solution to the wage gap. And it's really not the case. We really need to look after women who have a college education, have maybe a couple of years of community college, because opportunities for living wage jobs are just about non-existent for that group of women.
Living wage jobs. Yeah, that's a huge, huge issue these days. And we're happy to take your calls here. If you're in the area, well, you can call from anywhere. 603-430-9722 on the Burt Cohen Show today. Our guest is AFL-CIO organizer Judith Statman, talking about women, work, and wages. And Judith, you talked about self-selecting, and it was, you know, in the categories of jobs, the nonprofits, state jobs, municipal workers, health, education, social assistance. These are important jobs. I mean, our economic stability depends on things like this. And I wonder about the self-selection factor and why is it that these really important jobs pay less? And you mentioned like a parking attendant making more than, I forget what the category was.
Yeah, a child care worker. Well, typically, a parking attendant, parking lot attendants make more than child care workers, the people who are looking after infants and toddlers for 8 hours a day. People who will one day grow up and contribute to our society. I think it's very complicated. I do think that we live in a society where historically, and I'm not talking about, you know, just a few hundred years, but, you know, looking back across the span of human development, really, we've had thousands of years where women's work has been considered worthless than men's.
Right.
Although it may not come out of deliberate, you know, or overt discrimination, I think that there is still a sense in our society that the things that women do are not quite as valuable to us as the things that men do. And when we look at professions like teaching, when we look at professions like nursing, which can be a very good profession, particularly if nurses are in a union, which they are not in New Hampshire, you know, but and things like social assistance jobs, they are really, you know, they're underpaid based on the qualifications that are required to do that work. A good example is teachers. There was a survey done or an analysis done by the Economic Policy Institute on the earnings of K through 12 teachers. So, and they found that teachers who had a bachelor's degree or a master's degree were earning, you know, somewhere close to $700 a week. But then when they looked at other workers with the same educational qualifications, they were earning a lot closer to $1,000 a week. So, and teaching jobs can be very good jobs, and many teaching jobs are, you know, they are union jobs. So the gap between men and women in pay is somewhat narrower. But, you know, we just, there's the way that there are certain things that we don't value very highly when it comes to the care and development of children in particular, because that's always been women's work in our society. Caring for the sick has always been women's work in our society. So we do have a mindset that, not that this work isn't valuable, but just that we don't have to pay very much for it.
Yeah, I suppose we used to, I mean, back when there was the man was the head of household and you know, went out. That was the pattern. They went out, you know, 40 hours a week, and women stayed home and the work that they did there, you know, cooking, cleaning, doing the laundry, things like that, it was sort of taken for granted and it wasn't paid.
Right. And now, of course, we pay for a lot of those things, you know, as when we as two parents move into the workforce, yeah. You know, we're buying a lot more, you know, meals that can be popped into the microwave and you know, paying for other services as well. That's one of the ways that families have adjusted. But I think moreover, it's that even at the very top level of professions, there are differences between how male workers and female workers are perceived. And I'll just talk a little bit about one study that was done by an organization called Catalyst, which they particularly look at women in executive positions. And for years and years, women have been told, you know, well, you really have to, you know, you have to lean into your career, to use a popular slogan. You must, you know, you need to find a mentor. You should take every opportunity to put yourself forward, to put your work forward. You know, don't let anybody, your managers or the people who are making decisions about your job, forget about your achievements. To really be very assertive about, you know, claiming their competency in the job place
and reminding people and asking for more.
And one of the things that this study found was that women don't benefit from those career advancement techniques as much as men do.
Really?
The women who did, you know, just kind of checked off the entire list didn't get ahead in their careers as quickly as the men who did, and weren't paid as well. Their pay did not increase at the same rate. It wasn't that they fell back in their careers, but when, you know, they kind of followed the program for getting ahead, that's sort of the gospel in the corporate executive workplace. They were not benefiting from those approaches, and not to the same extent that men in the same position were. So,
wow.
There really are differences, and the Catalyst has also done a lot of research on you know, how what they just call cognitive bias affects women in the workplace. You
what
know,
does that mean?
It's not overt discrimination, but it's just sort of an unconscious sense that somebody is going to be better at doing something than somebody else. And what they found was that a lot of corporate managers, men and women, it's not, you know, there wasn't a lot of gender difference there, just, you know, had an innate sense that men would be better at doing the more responsible jobs than women would be, that men would be better at taking on additional responsibility in the workplace than their women cohorts, even if they had the same qualifications. So, and I do believe that probably happens, you know, on down the line of all, you know, it's just something that is endemic in our society. We have very, very structured cultural beliefs about gender in our society. And it plays out, you know, sometimes as you know, really direct and overt discrimination, but more often it's extremely subtle and not deliberate, but it still affects women's ability to advance in the workplace.
So it's fascinating that old ideas, old beliefs, even though they're not as direct. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, there'd be the want ads in the newspaper, and there'd be jobs for men, jobs for women. You don't see that anymore. But I, from what I'm hearing, there's kind of an old belief just kind of subtly underlying that, where that's not completely gone. And yet, you know, on TV, we see a lot of women executives, strong women executives. Is that not, there's sort of a cultural understanding now that, yeah, there's a lot of women business leaders and you know, CEOs and things like that. Some are paid exceedingly well. Does that picture on TV not reflect reality, especially here in New Hampshire?
Well, there are certainly, you know, some fantastically strong and competent women in business leadership. We have fantastically strong and competent women in political leadership, particularly in New Hampshire.
Yes, we
But overall, that's more of an exception than the rule. I think women are still... I don't know exactly what the current figure is in terms of the percentage of Fortune 500 CEOs who are women, but it's been around 5%, 10% for a number of years. The New Hampshire Women's Initiative, which is a group that looks at women's equality and pay equality, just recently put out a little study where they found that women are significantly underrepresented in business leadership in New Hampshire among the top earning companies.
Yeah, interesting. I suppose, you know, what we see on TV, you know, when you look at news, it's because it's out of the ordinary, you know, and so that's probably what happens on a lot of the images. How does New Hampshire compare to other parts of the country in terms of pay equity? You know, women work in wages in New Hampshire. I mean, we have a much lower unemployment rate than the national average, which is like 5.6 or something like that. Is New Hampshire about the same in terms of women work and wages, or are we slightly better, slightly worse?
Well, we are around the national average, but we do worse than some other states. Women's earnings, the wage gap is a little smaller in Vermont, for example, than it is in New Hampshire. It's smaller in Connecticut. It's smaller in Massachusetts. It does vary from state to state. One of the big an issue that's close to my heart, but one of the big differences for women and the wage gap is the rate of people who workers who are able to form, join, or belong to unions. And New Hampshire is a very modest to low rate of unionization the workforce. So that's unions are a real equalizer for women. They absolutely raise the floor for women in the work sites that have unions there.
Well, I wonder if there may be employers who say, you know, it's a very competitive world out there. If I pay women the same as men, I'm putting myself at a disadvantage, and the company won't be as profitable, and it won't be as, you know, helpful to the overall economy.
You know, sadly, that does happen. There's a fabulous book. It's called Getting Even. It was authored by Evelyn Murphy and co-authored by E.J. Graff, who was a fantastic investigative reporter in Massachusetts. It really talks about all of the factors that contribute to the wage gap for women, and one of them being that, and I have another acquaintance, Ellen Bravo, who was the founder of the organization 9to5, always writes that, you know, women aren't paid equally because employers don't pay them as much. And sometimes it really is that simple. What they found in Getting Even was that corporate bosses had figured out that it was more cost effective to pay for a few gender discrimination lawsuits, pay discrimination lawsuits, than it was to pay the women who worked for them equally. And that is just so callous, I can't believe it. But in those particular examples, the corporate heads were very aware that they were raising their profits by paying women less. And, you know, they figured they could do better if they continued the practice of underpaying women, even if they were sued. So,
wow, it's the overall race to the bottom is part of it, you know?
Indeed. And so in so many ways, a race to the bottom.
Yeah, and I was just hearing earlier today that in terms of telecommunications, instead of big companies like AT&T investing in, you know, improving services, why should they do that when their profits are more? It seems to be the overall way of doing business these days for, you know, but it's so short-sighted. It's so short-sighted. You know, we have an overall economy here. You know, people, you know, a lot of Republicans say, oh, you know, the economy's not getting better quick enough, that and they measure it by just, you know, how profitable are the big corporations. But in terms of improving the overall economy, I mean, isn't it really important that women step up? I mean, since we're asking them to do more and more these days, it's an odd, it's sort of a throwback. It's like an ancient, you know, way of looking at things that's still holding us back. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, well, it is. And you know, it's interesting. If you just think about, you know, if you ask the average woman, would she like a 23% raise right now? You know, I would say yes. But just even looking at in New Hampshire, what that wage gap is costing women. So for a New Hampshire woman who earns $9 an hour, which is, you know, that's around what the typical retail wage or food service wage. Because of the wage gap, she's not making over $4,300 a year. She's losing over $4,000 a year just because of the wage gap. So that's $4,000 that does not go back into the local economy. It's $89 a week. It's $358 a month. When you think of all of the things that money that is, you know, women deserve and are owed would pay for, and how that would boost our local economy, it's enormous. And we're talking about, you know, 42% of the workforce who are missing these dollars. And that's just for a woman who's earning, you know, just a little bit above the state minimum wage. For a woman in New Hampshire earning the median wage, I mean, she's losing close to $9,000 a year. It's closer to $750 a month and almost $200 a week. That is not available for retirement savings. It's not adding to her purchasing power, doesn't go into rent, doesn't go into, you know, buying cars or refrigerators or groceries. It's that money simply isn't there. And if that money was going into our economy would be a lot stronger.
Yeah, quite a bit. That's a fairly high percentage. Now, this can't be legal. It's not legal to pay women less for the same job, is it?
It is not. And it has not been legal to pay women less for a long time. And yet that hasn't changed anything. And I think that has drawn new attention to what's missing in our laws now that would help women catch up. One of the laws that's been proposed nationally is a legislature called the Paycheck Fairness Act. And what the Paycheck Fairness Act does, it's one of its primary provisions, is that it prohibits employers from retaliating against workers who share information about what they're earning with other people in their company. Yeah. So if Jane and Joe are doing the same job and they started at the same time and, you know, have progressed along the same way and have the same education and qualifications, and Jane turns to Joe and says, you know, hey, Joe, I'm making, you know, $40,000 a year. How about you? And Joe says, wow, I'm actually making $60,000 a year. Then Jane's going to know she needs to talk to somebody real soon about what's going on. A lot of employers actually prohibit that conversation from happening in their employee handbooks. It's not illegal to prevent employees from sharing information about their earnings. And it's actually an extremely common practice in the private sector. And so the Paycheck Fairness Act would actually prevent retaliation against employees who share information about their earnings.
I'm amazed. So there are actual, you know, employee handbooks where you're not allowed to discuss the pay salary difference. How much are you getting versus
it's a firing offense.
A firing.
It's a firing offense in some workplaces to share information about your earnings. And listeners may have heard about the Lilly Ledbetter Act. And the case with Lilly Ledbetter was that, you know, she found out many years after the fact that she was earning considerably less than men who had less seniority, less experience, doing the same job as she was for her employer. And when she tried to sue, the court said, sorry, the statute of limitations has expired on this. And the Lilly Ledbetter Act actually changed that from, you know, the statute of limitations clock starts ticking when you discover this discrepancy. So that was an important protection for women, but you know it doesn't help women who have women often don't know that they're being underpaid. You know, they don't know that the guy in the next cubicle who's doing exactly the same thing that they're doing and working the same hours and has the same experience is earning 15 to 20% more than they are from the first day on the job. So you know and employers actually do put policies in place in their workplaces that prevent that conversation from happening.
You're reminding me of a job I had in the late 70s. I was doing the same job as these two women. They had little cubicles. I had my own office. I was getting paid a lot more. They had more experience. It was unbelievable. I just couldn't believe it. And it sounds like, amazingly, a lot of this is still going on. So we need to look at a little bit of solutions. It sounds like there is that solution that you talked about, enabling people to talk to one another. Gosh, what a concept. What else? What could the legislature here in New Hampshire do? Have they been helpful in this on this issue, women work and wages, the discrepancy, or have they been roadblocks to it? What can be done here in New Hampshire about it, or is this more of a national issue?
I think there are certainly things we can do at the state level that will move things along for women in New Hampshire. One of them would be to, for example, Vermont has passed a state Paycheck Fairness Act. So uh-huh. They have passed a state law that says employers cannot retaliate against workers for sharing information about their earnings. We could certainly do something like that. We do have a fair pay law in New Hampshire, so the basic protection is in place. Obviously, it has not been 100% effective. Another thing that would help workers a lot is considering things like a mandatory paid sick days law, which was introduced, I believe it was in 2004 or 2006. Was not able to make progress in the legislation, but particularly for those lower wage women workers who don't have any sick leave. About 40%, I believe, workers in New Hampshire do not have any access to either paid or unpaid sick leave. If they get sick, or if a child gets sick, or if another close family member gets sick, women in lower wage jobs will often deal with that emergency by leaving their jobs or being fired because they've had too many days out. And then when they start with a new employer, it really keeps their earnings very flat because they're not with one employer long enough to sort of get that gradual increase of earnings that you get over time. So putting in something like a sick days act would help. I think we're unfortunately a long way from being able to do that in the state, but I think it's something that we really need to consider. And then there are states. California has passed a paid family and medical leave law, so have a couple of other states. But again, I think that's a kind of a leap of faith for New Hampshire at this point. But I do think that we can do more to raise awareness among employers about, you know, this is happening and really to make sure that women can find out whether they're being paid fairly or not.
Well, Judith Stanton, we started talking about in JFK's time, he 50 years ago put in an Equal Pay Act. It hasn't been completed yet. And of course, 50 years ago in JFK's time, the income disparity between men and women of color and white men was huge. And I would think that that has changed a lot, the black and white thing, but I don't know.
It's changed a little. I mean, we're certainly not there. When we talk about the general overall wage gap, we have to consider that African-American and Latina women, the wage gap for them is much larger compared to white men. Yeah. It's closer, I think, to... it's 30 or 40 cents. Wow. So it's really a big chunk of their pay that they are not getting. The gender discrimination, the racial discrimination in the workplace, it's certainly better than it was 50 years ago, but it's by no means gone. And it is one of the things that is holding working families back in America. And it needs to be resolved so that we can move forward as a nation.
So, Judy Stanton, again, thanks for being with us with the AFL-CIO. How can people, if people want to push on this and help make changes, there must be some way to get them involved.
Yes, absolutely. We would love to hear from folks who are interested in working on this issue. You can contact me. My phone number is 603-427. No, that is not my phone number. Here, call me at the office. This is the danger of having cell phones. It's 603-623-7302 at New Hampshire AFL-CIO.
New Hampshire AFL-CIO. Well, thank you so much. Progress is amazingly slow, isn't it?
You know, it is, but I think back over like the course of human history, and I think we've done pretty well in the last 100 to 50 years, but we've got a long way to go.
We do indeed. Well, thank you so much, Judith Stanton, for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show.
Woman is a nigga of the world. Yes, she is. Think about it. Woman is a nigga of the world. Think about it. That she's above us. So smart, we put her down for being It's a hurt.